You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 24th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. We learn the ropes of fashion journalism, delve into the magazine archives, and discuss the future of the printed daily. The past, present, and future of printed media are all thrashed out on this, a fully loaded issue of The Stack. This week, we'll be joined by two guests who, together, possess an encyclopedic knowledge of the magazine industry. One runs a school devoted to fashion journalism, and one has gone as far as amassing a whole archive devoted to fantastic magazines. Plus, this week, we get a special sneak preview of a new book that talks tough about the future of print.
I don't worry about the graphs. I don't worry as much as a lot of other people do about the graphs that suggest that trust in journalism keeps falling. I think these tests of opinion and research are largely artificial.
We'll also be going Dutch on two wheels as we go to Rotterdam to find out about a cycling magazine with style.
We want people to enjoy cycling, get them on the bike, let them enjoy the stories that are being told about cycling.
That and so much more in this issue 52 of The Stack. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards, holding the fort on behalf of your regular host, Tyler Brulé. Now, today we're going to be looking across the print spectrum, from teaching the art of fashion journalism to going down magazine world's memory lane. A lot to get through, so without further delay, let's meet our guests today. Having started her career at Elle before joining British Vogue in 1995, our first guest, Susie Forbes, set out on a path that led to senior and then deputy editorships at many prestigious magazines. In 2004, Susie became founding editor of Easy Living magazine, where she stayed until taking up the post of principal of Condé Nast College of Fashion and Design in September 2011. The college, a radical new concept, has become a fertile training ground for aspiring young fashion editors. Susie, welcome to The Stack. Thanks for coming in today. I guess I got to start by asking you about the college. Been going since April, I gather.
Yep.
How's it going? What's the first few months? What's the early report?
The early reports are very good, fortunately, because obviously, as I keep explaining to anyone who'll listen, the one is only judged in much the same way as magazines, by your output. So if your students are great and rave about your college, happy days. If they're a bunch of dullards, then your business plan is dead in the water because nobody wants to hire them, and they're going to complain about your course. So that's been an interesting, you know, we're an outward-facing business for the first time, looking after people, not inanimate objects or iPad editions of something. So it's been a very interesting journey so far.
And what about the reaction from across the media? I mean, it's kind of interesting because I can imagine, well, in reading at the time, there was a mix. There were some cynics. There were a lot of people who were very excited. How did you sort of gauge the spectrum? Did you feel like you got a fair shot? Did you think some people had kind of made their minds up even before they knew what it was actually you were doing?
Well, actually, it was a very useful construct for me because when the decision was announced for Condé Nast to go into education, now 3 years ago, the inevitable stream of generally criticism was aired, whether that's via social media or in the press, saying, you know, what do Condé Nast know about education? It'll be full of rich kids. If you have a checkbook, you can go. It's going to be a finishing school. It's going to be full of oligarchs' daughters. You can just imagine. And left alone in a room for a year to think about what we could do that would be seamlessly joined up with us as a company that would have the same values that we have as a publisher. Though I made about an 8-point list on a piece of paper of the things that got said time and time again, and thought, okay, how can I smash those out of the water and do it better? So in fact, those early criticisms were a very useful thing to push back against.
And did you find that did influence your thinking at all? Or as you said, it was just white noise that went on in the background. In terms of, for example, you know, it is an expensive business, higher education at the best of times, and it's perhaps more expensive than going to some of the it's more longer established schools. Was that a worry? Did you feel, I know there's support networks, you have scholarships, this kind of thing. Were you always mindful that was something you had to address, not just to resist criticism, but because it was the right thing to do?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that, you know, education is a sort of very, very wide spectrum. We're a tiny boutique offering, so we can't resolve all higher education problems within our one college. And what we were very mindful of was making sure that if you did pay the fee, that you got your money's worth. So far, so good, because we've had fee payers now come through and say that they couldn't have got the course anywhere else. So that was the most important thing.
Well, we'll be talking more about that as we go through the show, undoubtedly. We're also lucky enough to be joined on the stack today by a past visitor to the show. Joining us again, it's James Hyman. He holds the Guinness World Record for owning, what joy, the largest magazine collection, around 50,000.
Well, since we last were here, it was 53, but it's gone up to about 65. Remember, it's ongoing, so I'm going to try and beat my own record early next year.
This is a frightening thought.
It is.
Currently in the process of turning this vast library into an archive as a day job. James is also a respected music consultant and DJ. James, welcome.
Thank you.
Wow, I mean, explain to me how this process works. So you've gone up, what, 12,000?
Absolutely, because remember, there's gaps in the collection.
Oh,
so, you know, I might have NMEs from 40s to 2003, and I'm missing a few from 2005 or the odd. So it's that constant sculpting of filling gaps. New magazines come along. I want them. I want some back issues. That's why it grows.
Now, we discussed before, it was already sometimes problematic just acquiring this number, trying to archive them, manage them, the process. Your nearest and dearest, are they still as tolerant as the archive grows and grows?
She should be happy. We've just had a lovely second baby boy. I cleared where we live. There were the duplicates. I mean, it was literally sleeping on 20 years of Playboy, 20 years of this, that, the other, all over the place. They are gone. The flat where I live is completely, pretty much mag free, which, you know, so she's very happy with me at the moment.
That's
she
good.
Should be.
That's good stuff.
And yes,
sleeping on 20 years of Playboy.
Yeah.
That's an autobiography name right there for later
that's
in life.
Had yeah. another baby.
There you go.
Fantastic stuff. That is James and Susie here with me here on the Stack. We are going to be delving into the stacks of magazines that both guests have brought and talking about plenty more besides as we head through the show. Now on the Stack, we turn to the big and sometimes bad world of daily newspapers. Here on the show, we like to speculate on how we see the print landscape develop. More often than not, we meet magazine editors who can testify that, if anything, print is having something of a renaissance. However, it's often a rather different picture when it comes to printed daily newspapers, a rather different kind of beast. Often seen as a sinking ship, dailies are still a staple for many, and some show no sign of keeling over and going all digital. Well, not yet, anyway. What is clear is that editors and journalists are operating in a very different environment. Handily, Professor of Journalism at London's City University, George Brock, is about to publish his latest book, Out of Print. This in-depth but concise look at the business of news in the digital age is a must-read for journalists and non-journalists alike. Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck caught up with George and got an exclusive first read of the book.
The first thing we should say, and this is a show, of course, about print media, is that actually while you look at all the problems and all the issues facing the industry, you're kind of positive about the world of journalism and even about the survival of some print media.
I'm an optimist, you're absolutely right. I don't think that every newspaper is going to disappear. I think some newspapers will disappear. I think printed daily newspapers are going to be a less important part of news in the future. But I think books and magazines have quite a strong future, that a lot of them are doing fine at the moment. There are lots of forces of renewal, which are just as important as the forces of destruction and decay. And also one of the things I do in the book is I try and look and show people that the great age of daily newspapers was, as a historical event, really quite short. Big, mass, industrial-sized newspapers really only kind of reached full size in about the 1920s. Their peak, in circulation terms, was really the 1950s. And it was obvious to everybody by the 1990s that the business model for daily newspapers was in trouble. So historically, that's not a terribly long era.
Who do you think is going to navigate their way through what lies ahead? So we have these big media companies, many of them trying very hard to reinvent themselves, and some with good degrees of success, others less so. Next to them, we have lots of startups, lots of people trying to get in on the journalism game. Up to now, many of them have been kind of cannibalizing what the old media been doing, not doing anything very original. But I think in your book, you begin to point out that actually there are some interesting experiments going on. And I think you call it the spaghetti test. You lob things against the wall and you see what sticks, and the people doing that will begin to find some solutions. What are those solutions and who do you think will win through?
I tend to recommend to my journalism students that they apply a version of the spaghetti test, which is if they're thinking about who they might work for, they should really look hard for organisations that experiment energetically and that they experiment well.
So give me an example of somewhere where you think there's an experiment that's going on, or that someone has begun to kind of change the media model that you think is worth watching.
One of the examples that I use in the book is New York. And one of the reasons that some of my examples are from America is that this process of decay and replacement is a little bit more advanced in America than it is here, because the newspapers in America were more dependent on classified advertising, small ads, in other words, which collapsed faster. If I was the editor of the Metro section, that's the city section of the New York Times, there are a whole series of sites out there in New York which are starting to eat my lunch, and I'd be really worried. And one of them I concentrate on is a site called Gothamist.com, which is very, very kind of New York sensibility. It's very snarky, it's very fast, it's quite a little bit cynical, it's very interested in New York lifestyle, and absolutely only in New York. They're completely uninterested in the rest of America. They've got about 20 people working for them, right? There are 60 people working for the Metro section of the New York Times. Now, the Metro section of the New York Times has a lot of very good reporting on New York. But it can't continue to carry 60 reporters and squashing all those trees and putting ink marks on them at all the costs of that that's involved if people like Gothamist.com can do quite a lot of what they do with only the cost of digital publishing. So that little battle kind of encapsulates, if you like, what's going on. And the guy at Gothamist says, if I can just keep going at 20, I can really fight the New York Times because I'm three times more efficient than they are.
Do you think that news is something that we should pay for? You have a very good part in the book where you look at various media companies and their use of a paywall or not of a paywall, and how they experiment with those, and sometimes, you know, introducing them, sometimes taking them away, just seeing how their readers react. But do you think that people should pay to read journalism?
I think the solution to this dilemma lies in the particular circumstances of the kind of journalism you're trying to do. In other words, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all rule, and I do not think there's a single golden principle that answers the question. It makes no more sense to me to say news wants to be free than it does to say news wants to be expensive. If you are the Financial Times, for example, and people need your information in order to work and sound credible at work, there is a fairly good chance you're going to be able to make people pay for some of it. And they do, and that principle is working quite well for them. The real agony is for big, iconic, daily, general papers, which have all the costs of producing the paper and the big staffs that tend to go with them, that find it much harder to raise money on that model. That's where the dilemma gets really painful.
One of the examples you give in the book is the newspaper here in our home market, The Guardian, and you say it's quite likely that it will end up just as a digital publication and maybe moving more into the kind of comment territory. And you point out that actually they're still losing a huge amount of money. But once you've gone to being just a website, and that we haven't seen yet that real uptick of advertising, yes, it's moving over, yes, people are making a bit more incrementally, penny by penny. But once you give up on that, what do you think that a newspaper like that looks like in 10 years' time? Is that actually an organisation that doesn't look much different from the Gothamist?
Well, they're all going to look a bit more like the Gothamist, because with every year that goes by, more people are coming into the news reading market or the news consumption market who are completely familiar with doing this on phones, tablets, digital surfaces. And also, let's not forget, digital screens become more user-friendly all the time. An awful lot of people of my generation, say, remember early computer screens and think, how could anybody possibly want to read a newspaper on that kind of screen? Well, with every year that goes by, these screens become more and more attractive. We're going to get bendy screens. We're going to get optically more attractive screens. We're going to get screens on which you can do much more sophisticated typography and design, because the resolution will be so much better. I mean, you have to read for 30 seconds the discussions about the likely specifications of the iPhone 5S or iPhone 6 to see how rapidly these things are now advancing, and indeed screens and paper are practically converging in terms of optical quality. So that is evolving extremely fast. So that attitude, the premise behind your question, which is it's not really real if it's in print, is going to vanish quite quickly. And therefore, big institutions like The Guardian will be more digital than they will be in print. And my prediction about papers like The Guardian is that they're quite likely to end up with a print version, which is biweekly or weekly. That would make The Guardian a bit more like The New Yorker or Die Zeit, for example. And that might happen to quite a number of other papers.
And perhaps finally, you know, and we are trying to put a positive note here, but let's just look at another element you cover in the book, which is, especially here in the UK, the phone tapping fiasco, which kind of led to people having a very diminished view of what journalism represented and the people who were the purveyors of news in this country. Do you think that was a very localized story? Or do you think, you know, not that the phone tapping is happening elsewhere, but do you think that people still have faith in journalism and its future?
I think people have plenty of faith in journalism. They have become, if anything, over the last 20 or 30 years, consumers of news have become far more sophisticated and discriminating about what they see. They're much less likely to automatically believe something. They're warier and more skeptical. I don't worry about the graphs. I don't worry as much as a lot of other people do about the graphs that suggest that trust in journalism keeps falling. I think these graphs, these tests of opinion and research are largely artificial. I think it's a good thing that people are skeptical about journalism. They should be, because it isn't an easy activity to police. And in a free society, lots of people can now call themselves journalists. And in digital era, anybody can publish. So people should be skeptical and wary. But I also think that if you take the outputs that are long familiar, well established, you know, the trust figures for them remain very high. And so, you know, people don't turn around and react and first saying, is this true, when they've read it. They accept it. So there's a lot of normal journalism going on. It's just that in daily popular papers in Britain, something went disastrously badly off track.
That was Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck talking to George Brock, the author of Out of Print. Some pretty big issues raised in that interview. Susie, I wonder, what do you share George's sort of verdict on that, which is that people are sceptical, they're right to be sceptical, but actually there remains a great deal to be positive about, you know, journalism as a trade. It obviously gets maligned at times. The British tabloids haven't done anyone any favours. But do you think he's right that we should still be upbeat? There's still a lot to be proud of. And, you know, as a journalist of a number of years, are you still sort of proud of your trade, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of what he said was interesting, and there are many points to pick up on there. I think the bit about people don't just sit there, unfortunately, possibly saying, is that true? Is that right? You don't think like that when you're reading a paper. And I think when we're talking about, you know, survival of papers or not, the Daily Mail and also their website and everything else comes into that about what we perceive as news and journalism. You know, we're not just talking about long form journalism in The New Yorker. I think one of the really interesting things he just said was about The Guardian and the future of The Guardian. And would their paper product end up being a sort of, bi-weekly summation, and it brings into kind of the area of like the week. And if, you know, a part of why I have faith in magazines, particularly something like Vogue, is the edit. And we all know about the edit of the internet. So if everything is going digital, will there still be a place for a paper or digital version of that that surmises the news for people? And the week seems like a sort of hopeless construct now when you can get everything on the day, and yet it survives and is very popular because people still need, albeit retrospectively, an edit. And I think that could be, for The Guardian, one of a very interesting route for them to go for a paper product.
I mean, it's interesting, James. What I wondered about that is, we talk about, you know, curating the internet, these kind of things. You're obviously an aficionado of magazines. You know so many. There's editors you'll sort of trust their vision. You particularly want to read what they do, what their view of the world is. Do you ever get worried about the internet? You know, we're all pretty media, new media savvy. Do you worry that it's not curated, that there's not the sort of standards of guaranteed? You know, everyone is an editor now. Everyone's a citizen journalist.
Yes, but there are still areas that are well curated. You know, you go to The Guardian or The New Yorker or whatever you like and trust, and they will replicate a lot of their content digitally, and it has still got that very good high trust factor. There is a lot of mess. There's a lot of glut. But those things are probably not really done physically. So those, you know, those physical magazines replicate themselves digitally. And you're right, you need that curation, the filtering. So I apply it to my, you know, in what I do with the music. A DJ filters music for you. He's the selector. He's saying, here's a load of stuff. Trust me, you know me, I've got a good reputation. The Guardian, whatever we're looking at here, all these Vogue, they've got those inbuilt trusts. So people, I don't think, are going to be biased to them digitally or physically.
But some of the things that George touched upon there, this idea of the citizen journalist, often lauded, and rightly in some cases, as a great development. Everyone has the opportunity, people can get their voice out there, and often it is vital that it's heard. But that does lead to some question, doesn't it, about people who, you know, they don't have the editor, they're not schooled, if you like. Susie, I wonder, you know, still working in that world, having worked in magazines and sort of now shaping, you know, promising futures, is it feasible to you to have a citizen journalist who doesn't have any training, who hasn't come through that sort of structure?
Well, democratization is the overused word of the moment, obviously, and, you know, that is what's happened. So the bloggers have, in terms of fashion journalism particularly, have had an enormous impact, and that's included, you know, Tavi, who was a very young girl when she started her blog and is now in the front row at the shows. I think based on a lot of editors and journalists who've come in to talk at the college recently, you know, the blogger thing seems to have settled down in terms of fashion journalism. I think in the end, the dust does come back down to settle on expertise, that there was that explosion of freedom and everybody having a voice. But again, it comes back and back and back to this thing that we can't all look at all those people and hear all their voices. No one's got enough time in the day. So for me at Condé Nast, you know, as a company, you know, we are the leaders of editing taste and style. And that is in our DNA, whether it's manifested digitally or in paper. And that is the thing that people will always come to us for, because you cannot absorb all of those voices and all of those people. Whether it's right or wrong that they exist, I think probably right. But, you know, the best will out. Because
it's a media Darwinism again. How many of those Twitterati or whatever are going to be heard, listened to? They may have loads and loads of followers. That dust, you know, Susie's right, that dust settles and some of them will make their name, make their mark. And look, I'm looking at the disrupting thing. You look at, going back to that thing about being schooled in the print and the journalism, look at a magazine like Vice. They're kind of renegades the way they started up. They did it. They did it in their style. Now, I'm sure there were plenty of people who saw Vice, started like Vice, failed miserably, had one issue gone. Not everyone will survive.
But do you think that's, I mean, is that a good thing?
Yeah, because that is survival of the fittest. In print, media, digital, definitely. It's a Darwinism approach to print, media and journalism, definitely. Not everyone's, great, we can all, you know, what is it, that teacher might get a monkey, eventually he's going to write Shakespeare. Not everyone's going to be able to do this. You know, they might be able to take their Instagram photos, Twitter, do it all, but they're not all going to become, you know, have their pieces in Vogue, New Yorker, Rolling Stone. It just won't happen.
I just wonder, is there an impatience, do you think? I wonder, Susie, whether you've seen this changing. Do you see people who want to sort of fast-track themselves to being the person in the front row at the shows, and they're not willing to, you know, do a bit of old-fashioned graft, learn their trade, get, you know, learn from the experts, learn from the
best.
There
is a little bit of that, although I don't think there's many stories of those who've succeeded via that route. I think the exciting bit about that impatience is the kind of entrepreneur culture that grows up, that you can now, you can fast track it. And I'm, you know, I'm certainly not shackled to old school routes into journalism if there is another route to success and money and happiness or whatever it may be you're seeking. You know, I don't feel that everybody necessarily has to do their time, but I can't think of many people who I admire who are in positions of influence who you could fast track to being. There are other routes into work and into owning a business from an entrepreneurial point of view from your bedroom, but you cannot learn to be a journalist, in my opinion, A, in a college. You have to learn it in your place of work, or B, fast. So there are some things I don't think you can fast track, but I think some exciting things that are completely different now, that young kids can think, actually, it's really hard for me to get a job, so I'm going to do something myself. I'm not sure where journalism quite fits into that, but I think that's a wonderful thing.
It reminds me, again, it's cropped up recently because he readdressed it in this week's New Yorker. It's the Malcolm Gladwell outliers. It's the 10,000 hours as well. You've got to put that graft in. However you do it, you may not go those traditional routes. You might be a renegade in your bedroom doing your Paris Hilton weird blog, but it's going to take you time. You're not going to suddenly, you know, do it in 5 days. So yeah, it is the graft, however you do that graft.
That's a good lesson for everyone. There's no real shortcuts. A good lesson here.
So my dad always tells me it hurts me at times.
Absolutely. Yeah, dads are always right in the end. As is the custom here on the Stack, we're going to be delving into our stacks of magazines in just a moment. I'm with James Hyman and Susie Forbes, so we'll be taking a look at what they've brought with them right after this.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibuken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
Indeed, it is time on this week's episode of The Stack to ask our assembled print experts to present some of their favourite titles from past and, particularly this week, I'm delighted to say, the past as well as the present, two tasty stacks on the table. Let's begin. Perhaps, James, do you want to kick us off today? Where should we start? Vintage first up?
Or? I was going to do something topical and newsworthy. Two reasons for choosing this Rolling Stone. Again, it's one of the only magazines I kind of read regularly because it's got its finger on the pulse. I like to dip in. It crosses the pop culture. But this caused controversy. This August the 1st issue 1188, has got the picture of the bomber, that Boston bomber on the front. Mm. I don't know if you all read about this. There was a lot of outrage because the way they put him on here makes him look like he's a, you know, Jim Morrison kind of rock and roll star.
What was your first, when you learned of, or first, I don't know if you saw it first or heard about it
first. I heard about it on the net.
Did you think, wow, this is gimmickry? Or did you think, good old Rolling Stone pushing the envelope?
I thought both. I thought it is a gimmick because he's beautifully airbrushed. But as a lot of people say, read the story, which is a fantastic piece of journalism. The story is not going to sensationalise him. As I dig deeper, let's say here, look, Time magazine had Hitler on its cover. They've had Charles Manson on the cover. There's a lot of controversial people being on magazines. I think it was the New York Times actually had this picture.
Oh, on
before
front page
the Rolling Stone. So it's the context of the magazine. I guess it's Rolling Stone is this cool, hip, trendy thing. And people have argued that it's made this guy glamorized. But I think I'm split. I mean, what do you both think? I would actually like to know what you both think.
That season.
Yeah. What do you think?
Where did you stand on that one?
Well,
at the time?
I haven't read Rolling Stone for a long time, I'm ashamed to say.
Okay,
and so I'm just interested to know how often they do not have a rock or musician on the cover. Is this a regular thing?
I would say they'll have Simon Cowell. They'll have a pop culture person. So
this is news. So it's a bit like, you know, when I was working on Vogue, and we always talked a lot about what is outside the parameters of working on a fashion magazine. What features shouldn't you run? Because it's irrelevant to your audience, and it shouldn't have Vogue on the masthead, which I imagine is a conversation had at Rolling Stone about that feature. Is this a feature that should be in Rolling Stone, or is it?
It's a very good point. I mean, can I read you the two quotes? So the mayor of the Boston mayor, he said, "Look, this is terrible. It reaffirms a terrible message that destruction gains fame for killers and their causes." Now, Rolling Stone defended this by saying, "Look, within the traditions of journalism, Rolling Stone's longstanding commitment to serious and thoughtful coverage of the most important political and cultural issues of our day, and they have always done that. Hunter Thompson, whatever, they have all been political and not always been celebrities." So they argue that, you know, and they said it will appeal to teenagers. It says he's young, the same age group as many of our readers. It makes it all the more important for us to examine the complexities of this issue.
Intriguing stuff.
What do you think? What do you think, Tom?
Well, yeah, I probably play devil's advocate. I think it was interesting you cited that New York Times example because clearly that was a news story. It was in a news context, and I think you've got a lot more latitude. It was intriguing, Susie, you alluded to these meetings at Vogue.
Yeah.
How I would love to have been a fly on the wall. what were some, obviously without going to specifics perhaps, what were some of the issues that were thrown up then, if memory serves? Were there any particular
examples?
Well,
it doesn't quite serve, but I'll give you a recent example, which is they just, we had the features director, Jo Ellison, in to speak recently, and she, they'd just done a piece about women in the police, and the students quite rightfully at the college sort of say, well, how do you take a subject and make it Vogue if it's a little bit near the fringe of, you know, that's not a piece about white trousers, is it? So it's not classic fashion journalism. And of course, some of that is smoke and mirrors, which is that when you run that piece, you make those women or men look as stylish as possible. You know, there's an appropriate visual delivery of that piece, but they can go into a little bit of hard journalism where it's appropriate and where they feel it's topical. And Vogue, in its own way, is a very, very important barometer of the zeitgeist and always has been. In the way Rolling Stone is for music, Vogue is for fashion. And so all these things feed in all the time and become, you know, kind of very important of their moment.
Absolutely. Susie, let's start with your stack of magazines today. Where would you like us to begin? Perhaps we should start with Vogue. Perhaps.
Well, the most important reason I bought it is because for the first time I'm in it. This is a moment in anybody's life, and I'm extremely proud to be finally in a September issue. 10 years or so having not worked there, I'm in it, so I am a gratuitous choice.
And it made the reassuringly heavy sound that we expect from that celebrated edition. And what about your views of this? It's obviously always a bit of a marquee moment, isn't it? With your sort of Vogue hat on,
interesting, because obviously I've been out of magazines as such. I mean, I'm working at Condé Nast, but heading up the college for a couple of years. And when the new edition comes, there's always a kind of Marmite reaction to covers. And my vice principal, who is a man, generally opposes my "I like a cover, he hates it." And I actually love this cover and think it's a sort of classic Vogue cover, for better or worse. And he was like, "No, I don't get it." And he tends to like the more directional things that they do. But I'm at ease with it, and I can't wait for it to thump down on my desk in that reassuring way that it does each month.
So we should really say, I mean, in terms of commercial, this is, to sort of describe this cover for our listeners,
I believe.
Yeah.
In an orange leather jacket. It's a white background, you know, eye contact. She's got lovely hair. She's the sort of person you'd want to look like, as opposed to a kind of edgier, more challenging, more arty cover. And I think what's tricky for print generally, and even for Vogue, is that you do need to be commercial in print now. Even Vogue needs to look after that. So where you used to be able to scatter your year with, you know, what the hell covers, I don't think there's much what the hell in magazines anymore.
And what about what does the big numbers at the newsstand? I mean, is that still a real factor?
Would this
be viewed then as is it a conservative choice? Is it pragmatism? Or you just think they have to be more mindful about balancing the bolder choices with the traditional?
I think that, you know, this is a classic September issue. It's one of the biggest sellers, the biggest selling issue of the year. You're not going to frighten the horses on your you know, biggest selling issue. Why would you do that?
Give the public what they want. James, let's come back to you now. We are now dipping into the archive, are we?
We are going to go a little vintage because, you know, I did a lot of stuff for the Bowie Is at the V&A, which is their most successful thing to date. So I dug onto some 80s stuff here because, again, the V&A have got another thing at the moment, from Clubland to Catwalk. And you actually see some good importance for magazines there. You go in there, it's fantastic. I think you walk in and you see a Yamamoto, this kind of inflatable cool outfit. He's holding a great issue of ID. They actually got a lot of the mannequins holding magazines, showing that those magazines, which I should name, like The Face, ID, Arena and Blitz in the 80s, were, said this to Susie outside before, they were the internet of the time. You know, magazines were your zeitgeist. You, they're my Bible. It's arrived, The Face, let me have a look. You know, it's taken for granted nowadays, but at that time, and you see that a lot in the exhibition. I mean, surprised they didn't include this, actually. This was The Face number 34 from Feb 83, The Making of Club Culture. That was great. And then look at this. I must show you this as well. Obviously, it doesn't translate well, but dig it out and get a Google image of it. But ID number 7 from very early 80s for 75p. That cover is fantastic. That today, I think, if you put that on the racks of the top shelf, which is now fashion porn, or your Vogues, Dazed, Tens, whatever, that stands out.
It's a striking. It's what we got. Dayglow colours.
Dayglow.
I don't know
who that is, to be honest.
It jumps out at you. This is a great note to strike on the stack.
So
very
go.
Pleased with that. More from Susie Forbes and James Hyman a little later in the stack. But next up, we're going to be taking to our bikes in Rotterdam. You're listening to edition 52 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now, if there's something the Dutch are crazy about, it's bicycles. So no wonder that when the creatives of a small agency in Rotterdam wanted to show their clients how to produce a top quality magazine, they chose to talk about cycling. But this, though, is not your conventional cycling magazine. Soigneur is thoughtful, modern, stylish, and pays a lot of attention to detail. Premium photography and top-notch design are as important as trails, gears, and technical specs. Cynthia Taylor visited Swanier's newsroom in Rotterdam to speak to the magazine's editor, Femke Hureland.
This is the office. Hi. So this is Martijn Boot, editor-in-chief. Willem de Kam, photographer-designer. Jeroen Boot, designer. Martijn van Egmond, photographer-designer. That's it. That's the Swanier team. Swanier is the person who keeps the cyclists riding. He used to do everything for the professional cyclist to get him on the bike. So he was the masseur, he was the therapist, he was the one who feeds them. He was the one who was around all the time. So that's why we choose that title. We want people to enjoy cycling, get them on the bike, let them enjoy the stories that are being told about cycling.
Why did you decide to do this magazine?
We're a graphical design agency and we love print and we make magazines, and we thought our clients made the wrong decisions by going cheaper and cheaper with cheaper paper, cheaper prints, and we thought higher quality. Print needs to be in high quality, timeless, slow reading, good stories, good paper, lots of details.
So you wanted to prove them wrong?
Yes, and we did actually. Yes, we wanted to prove them wrong, yes.
And why cycling? Why a cycling magazine?
We're with five people who started Swanier. We all have something with cycling, and it's a great sport where you can make a magazine about. It has old stories, new stories, it has heroes, it has losers, it has surroundings, it's romantic.
But it's not the conventional cycling magazine that you can find on stands nowadays.
No. Actually, the code is for books, so it's really, we're actually selling as books, so it's very timeless. It's not conventional. We don't give tips. There's no scoops in it. There's no gossip in it. We just want the good stories. It's very slow. It's very timeless. And we focus a lot on photography. There's the paper. It's ecological paper. The print is ecological. So we have all the details which are important. Every detail is important about it. So whether it's writing, whether it's photography, whether it's the print, every part of the magazine needs to be thought of. And I believe other magazines don't do that. So it's all about the romantic, the love for cycling. That's what makes it different.
So if you can just go through some of the examples you have here in the magazine, for instance, what would be the highlights?
Well, for example, we have fiction. There's a writer here, for example, Frank Heine, who made a fiction story about someone who hates Tour of Flanders. There are short stories as well, like the one at the barber. We always ask sharp questions to them and short questions, and we have the knife on their throat. So that is the deal with it. There's always amateur in it. There's always a pro cyclist interview with it. We have two photo series on special paper every time we ask a photographer to have their pictures.
How many stories can you actually tell about cycling?
A lot. It's like if you go way back, there's so much stories, and it's about people, it's about locations, it's about technical the cycling. It has it all. It's fashion. It's a never ending story. Actually, it can go on and on.
Cycling, it's not a sport that you would associate with style, but yet with this magazine, that seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Cycling used to be very traditional in Holland and not very stylish. The English made it stylish, actually. Like Rafa and like Rouleur, there's the new cycling, and they made it seem like, okay, you can have nice clothing on cyclists and you can have good designs in it. That's new. And we are part of that new thing.
So the magazine basically wants to bring the style into cycling.
Yes, definitely, yes. It needs that. No, definitely yes. We don't want to have a magazine filled with spandex. We want fashion shoots and not sports photography. So that's the difference in that.
So is this magazine for those who love cycling, or is this magazine for those who still haven't found the love for cycling?
I hope both. Of course, it's for those who love cycling and It's actually also for a large group of graphical designers, advertising agencies, for example. They also love the magazine. We are in New York, in Tokyo, in South Africa. So despite of the fact it's in Dutch, there is interest from abroad. So people are buying the magazine for the design and photography as well. So that is maybe the difference. It all has every aspect is very important, which is as well as the design, as the photography, as the text.
That was Soigneur magazine's Femke Hurland talking to Monocle's Cynthia Taylor. And now back to the best bit, I think, of the stack. Our magazine review. It continues with Susie and James. Susie, let's return to your side of the table here, covered with delightful magazines. Where should we turn next?
Well, some of them are not that delightful, because I think in the brief was your favourite and your least favourite. We won't loiter.
Get the least favourite. Come on, that's
I never knew a least favourite.
It's not the least favourite, because it's a sort of new and important tool in my life, but it is the Times Higher Education magazine, which just makes me smile as I see it on my bedside about how my bedside even about how my life has changed. It's actually, albeit rather dry, a very expert and useful tool. But moving on, I have actually brought this new magazine along called Hole and Corner, which has been launched by a former colleague of mine, also from Vogue, in case you think I'm obsessed. and it's the sort of, I suppose it's the kind of wondrous optimism of a kind of slow journalism. So it's very craft-driven. It's all about people making cheese and spinning things and the wonderful world of craftsmanship. And I admire him immensely for launching a magazine in September 2013.
Absolutely. I think we had a mention of Hole and Corner before. They featured on the stack. So
good.
The kind of work that we like to encourage here on the show. What is it about the magazine? What makes it, do you think, well, what will hopefully make it such a success? Do you have is there particular sort of elements of what they've...
One's in danger of showing one's age, I think, about this sort of endless hope that slow things will continue to exist. And obviously it's a sort of jargonistic thing about slow food and so everything else. But I don't know whether the 3D printing thing and everything else that's happening around making stuff will... Someone said to me when I was working at Vogue House, they said, you know, as soon as the last magazine goes out of print, somebody will print another one. So it's like you can't keep a good thing down. And I think it's amazing that so many biannual fashion magazines are launching. I mean, there's tens of them coming out all the time. They're full of advertising. This is far away from that, not full of advertising. But, you know, it's just there is a thirst for print, and it's just about getting it right about what you put out there. And it's a wonderful thing. I don't think my children would like it, but it's not aimed at them. So if they can get the right market and they can pay for it to exist, I think fantastic.
Good stuff. I like that kind of story. And also, I mean, slow journalism, I think, is really interesting. You said it's a little bit...
Delayed gratification, I'm sure.
Exactly. We had delayed gratification, I think, just on last week's show. And it's such an important approach to be more considered. We talked about the curated view of the internet, but to take even a curated view of print over the last few months... very important to change the pace sometimes.
With you 100%.
That's good. We're all in agreement. This is a rare moment on the stack. James, let's continue with your part. Where should we go next?
A little quick tail end, because I'm always a complete quick tail end on those 80s, by the way. Those were fantastic. Again, you could just look at a magazine to be nostalgic. Fantastic in that ID, issue 52, October 87. Just look at that Grace Jones again. Dig out a Grace Jones Olympus OM707 ad. You don't really get cool ads like that anymore.
That's of its moment.
Keeping on that retro, because you told me to bring some retro. I love this magazine. I had a stack of these the other day that I was just delving into. Colours. This magazine was created by Tibor Kalman and Oliver Toscano. I think it was in around about 1991. I'm pretty sure, maybe Susie knows, I'm pretty sure Benetton funded it. They did fund it. Yeah. And again, actually going back onto the museum thing, the whole series of colours was shown in the Design Museum sometime in 2007. It was a 25-25 exhibition. But look, they did a theme every issue. So you got here just fat.
That's
fat.
That's a pretty arresting cover, that one.
A very good, fantastic covers. Toys.
Rubber duck
AIDS.
There.
Yeah, shopping, where you could buy this $98,000 Bijan Beverly Hills 18 karat gold gun. And then something I remember, I love this issue on Time. There was this great quote in there about, I think it was a drug addict saying that how he blinked and 30 years just went past his life. But it was thematic. It was controversial. I think they got in trouble for doing something to do with the Pope. Maybe some, the Queen is black and the Pope is whatever, African. It was all interesting,
because
controversial.
At the time, they were running all of those ad campaigns where they were kind of embracing race and colour. I mean, obviously,
I think it was a death row. That was, I think, they had something to do with a guy on death row, and Toskiana, I think, got fired from that. But I think it's still going on.
It was very all the ad campaigns were all about inclusivity.
Yeah.
But they certainly tweaked quite a few noses. Do you think, Susie? I mean, that was a lot of quite bold editing. There was a whole huge brand strategy across fashion industry at that time. There would be magazines, there'd be ad campaigns. It was very sort of holistic. Do we still see the same kind of scope, the same kind of ambition? Or do you think that people are almost necessarily slightly more limited in terms of what they can do across all those different media like that?
I don't think so. I think, it depends. There's so many magazines, so it's hard to generalise. I think watching you flick through the covers, and again, I appreciate that you can't see them, but the fat one had somebody with a not at all pleasant body on the cover, is that, one has to weigh up what is a newsstand magazine and how much of your business is dependent on the newsstand. Because looking at that very commercial cover of Vogue, you still need to put that magazine out there and make people pick it up. So, it depends how dependent you are on that commerce. If you're a purely subscription title, you can push the envelope as much as you like. Or if you're a small circulation title, again, you can be as creative and interesting as you want. But everybody has to understand who their audience is. And if you need a volume of readers, then much as we were semi-maligning it earlier, let the reader have what they want.
Absolutely. That's an intriguing point about the sort of commercial imperatives that, of course, surround all of these businesses. Ultimately, they need to, most of them need to survive. Few are fortunate enough to be able to sustain these things because of backers and that sort of thing. But when you're talking to students in the college, for example, how much of a factor is that if you talk about, say, the fashion media? Is it as much about explaining the place in the world of fashion that has, how it fits in, how it's commercial?
Yeah.
Or is there still the chance for people who say, well, I want to cover this industry, I want to write about it, I want to photograph it, and it's more about the aesthetic, or it's more about the quality of the writing? Is there room for that, or is that too romantic almost?
No, I think probably a lot of them arrive at the more romantic end and then
have that thrashed out of them.
The word business hasn't probably occurred to most of them. The amount of letters that I've had over the years on magazines from readers saying there's too many adverts in your magazine, well, that is because they keep the lights on. We cannot have a magazine unless we have ads. So there's a sort of innate, rather lovely, sort of naive misunderstanding about how magazines are in business, which is because of advertising. And I think the students arrive entirely appropriately young and, full of dreams, wanting, to write about the industry, to be part of it, to create magazines. And then without trying to trample on those dreams, we do explain about how business today, particularly, and 360 business across iPad and digital and everything else. So I hope they go away still wanting to be part of that business, but probably a bit savvier about what that means.
I wonder, James, would you, as a collector over many years, do you think have appreciated, benefited from going to some sort of, the finishing school of magazines, learning about them from the inside out? Or do you actually prefer the knowledge, the relationship that you have developed just through being a consumer? Is that much more important to you than understanding the sort of nuts and bolts of it?
I mean, I guess, as I said, I think touched on it before, MTV schooled me because it was pop culture, so I was mirroring that in magazines. My degree, again, we couldn't do the beauty of a Condé Nast course back then, show my age. I don't know if I would like to have been rigidly schooled. I think it's lovely to maybe have it parallel, that maybe you're doing, which is, again, I did. I worked at MTV while I did a degree. I like that parallel universe of your learning, and maybe you're putting that into practice rather than just doing the course. Because, as we all know, you do a course, there's no guarantee you're going to get the employment or end up doing what you want to do. So I just enjoyed, fortuitously, being able to go along a path that led me into slight lunacy and a Guinness World Record.
They're both good places to be. I just wonder, Susan, I know this is another question that's probably been put to you since you took the role at the college. People say, fashion is it's an oversubscribed industry anyway. There's already too many people who want to work there. you know, is the time right, you know, post 2008, all this kind of thing, is the time right to try and be, you know, be schooling people into that business? Is it oversubscribed, or is it still important to provide, you know, great education in a business to people who will be the big contributors down the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things to say about that. One, you know, the British Fashion Council about a year ago put out a big report that got a lot of publicity about the value of the fashion industry. Nobody had actually put a sum of money on it to say, we make more out of fashion than we make out of cars. These are really important statements as a nation to put out there so that people generally understand how big an industry it is. And it's also a growing, a massively growing industry in the UK, and a very changed one. When I started in magazines or in fashion, fashion designers like Alexander McQueen, whoever it might have been, were here. They had relatively small businesses, they had no global reach, and now you can be part of this amazing new generation of designers whose collection, if they're talented, will be on Net-a-Porter within a year and is on the red carpet in Los Angeles in the same season. So they've got global reach, they're based in London, they're business-minded. So this is a huge industry for the UK. And interestingly, we are a college not teaching people how to be fashion designers. What a lot of these companies are coming to us, you know, begging us to provide them with are people who don't want to be the designer, but wanted to go into those multitude of other jobs and they don't know where to recruit them. So there's a kind of, there's a mismatch between actually a huge availability of jobs and people to go into them.
Let's head, unfortunately, towards the end of the show, but we can wrap up a little. James, I wanted to just ask you, we know about your ongoing archiving. What should we be looking out for? Because we talked before about, and you mentioned a few of these exhibitions that feature magazines all across this country and globally. What exciting things are coming up? Should we be looking out for the next few months, both for you and your ridiculously large collection? And what about across the magazine world more generally? Are there things you're really looking forward to maybe finding out even more? Are there new titles you're still hoping to read?
Well, certainly more museum action. As I said, I mentioned that Northampton Mold one and the work we did on the Bowie V&A. So I like seeing that. There's a new film coming out showing what we've been doing with the archive and working still on getting this museum space. But again, just tying up, actually, if I can just squeeze in the last one, because this is an exciting thing. Again, I'm going back quickly just onto Vice, because I'm sure you heard the news this week that Murdoch bought a 5% stake in it for $70 million. And that means that Vice is valued at $1.4 billion. That excites me. Again, showing power of the magazine world. This thing started as a free local magazine. It's still free. Its content on the net is free. So really ending up, I'm excited that magazines have got that power now that... how can you say that's dead when someone like Murdoch is putting, you know...
I mean, any trepidation about that, though, Murdoch? Because obviously we've seen Murdoch buying into, you know, new media.
But he bought MySpace. But everyone, I think if you dig deep on that, he did well on that deal. He made it... people laughed him. As I understood it, he did very, very well and made a lot of money back off that very quickly from its advertising. So I don't think he's a fool to put in $70 million...
A controversial reading, I would say. It's okay. We can agree to disagree for our listeners.
Yeah.
James is looking at me menacingly. So, Susie, I'll just come to you. Let's just talk about, very briefly, the college. What should we expect to see? More courses, perhaps? Or what about the stellar early graduates? Are we going to see them with their names up in lights?
Yeah, well, we've started with 10-week courses, and then the year-long students begin shortly in October. And from our first cohort, they're already leaping into jobs, believe it or not, some of them on printed magazines, can you believe it? And not just Condé Nast. Important that we're not perceived to be a feeder school for our own company. We don't have room for all my students. And they're pushing off into the wider fashion industry. And yes, I mean, we're called the Condé Nast College, not the Vogue College, because why wouldn't we in a year's time be running Wired courses or something else from our stables? So very exciting potential. We've got some amazing brands, and they would all make a good platform for education.
Wonderful stuff. That brings us to the end of this edition of The Stack from Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. My guests today have been Susie Forbes and James Hyman. Our producer was David Pleasant, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and the show was edited and studio produced by Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, until next time, goodbye.